Friends, this has been Christian Hunter with you in the program we call A Time for Prayer. And what a joy it's been to be with you before the throne of grace. Thank you for being with me. Thank you for listening. Thank you for participating in this vital prayer and worship ministry. May God bless you. May God bless you. Write to us as often as you can at A Time for Prayer, in care of radio station KFER, P.O. Box 13, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. It will be a joy to hear from you. And until next time, God bless you. Keep on praying. Worship the Lord in spirit and in truth. Amen.
Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners of management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests. And, tonight, we, of course, invite your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls because we have a very, very special guest tonight. His name is Alan Wanger. We're beginning to talk about the Shroud of Turin, an adventure of discovery. Now, for centuries, the Shroud of Turin has been an unfathomable mystery. Called by some the Holy Shroud, it's an ancient piece of linen that's 14 feet 3 inches long and 3 feet 7 inches wide, which bears many images, the most noticeable of which are the front and back of a crucified man. It's been homed in the Cathedral of St. John and the Baptist in Turin, Italy, since 1578, and may well be the most intensely studied single object in history. Mary and Alan Wanger began the study of the Shroud after seeing a photograph of the Shroud's face in 1977. They had no preconceptions about its authenticity, but she, with a degree in religion from Duke University, and he, Alan, is a professor at Duke University Medical Center, although in unknown territory, conducted their research into the Shroud scientifically, with painstaking thoroughness, dedication. And that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. We've all heard of the Shroud of Turin. Is it real? Is it a fraud? And, of course, what did Alan and Mary Wanger discover? Thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
Fine, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Well, let's, just for our listeners' sake, now, let me introduce you. You are a physician. You, of course, were trained as a surgeon. You became a psychiatrist. You went off on the missionary. You became a surgeon again. And, of course, then you worked at Duke University Medical School for many, many years. Is that correct?
Right. I'm also trained in tropical medicine and geriatric psychiatry.
All right, fine. But,
a lot of things.
But, of course, you've been fascinated for 25 years by this, almost 30 years now. What is it? Let's see, when did you get started on this? 1977, 25 years by the mystery of the Shroud of Turin. Some people say, you know, it was a hoax. But of course, after reading your book and following in your footsteps, I think that there's so much there to demonstrate that this really is exactly what it's said to be. Now, why don't you tell us how these images were found on the linen? I mean, how did the images get there?
All right, fine. Well, that is sort of the ultimate question. That's the mystery of history. Is that they actually? I was never aware of the Shroud until 1977. That wasn't nearly as widely known a number of years ago as it is now. When I first saw an image of it, it immediately struck me as something very unusual. As photography is my main hobby, and combined with my medical background sort of made me think, well, that's very intriguing. And so we began studying it, and then we got the challenge to determine how old it was, because the reason I heard about it was because the Shroud was intensely studied in 1978. It's ordinarily locked up except for about once a generation, which brought briefly to public viewing, and was brought out in 1978. And at that time, a group of about 40 international scientists went over to study this. And actually, the question that they went with was, how did that image get on there? You know, since that's a scientific question, and they didn't have any answers. This group of scientists that worked day and night did over 1,000 different tests, took 32,000 photographs of it during that time. And after all this study, well, their conclusion was they didn't know how the image got on there. They could describe what it was and what it wasn't, but they couldn't explain it.
Is it like a burn, or what is it?
Well, it looks like a very light scorch, that has that color. So some have compared the Shroud to sort of an old ironing board cover that's been singed in places. But there's that the results of the scientific study in 78 indicated that this was no contact or artistic image, because there's no paint, pigment, dye, stain, anything of the sort on it. They could describe the image, which is a physical chemical alteration in the surface fibrils of the linen, as that technically it's dehydration and decarboxylation of the cellulose molecules of the linen, which produces a light yellow color. And so that is actually the basis of it. What did that is the big question. All sorts of things have been speculated, but the researchers found that there was many peculiarities of the image. Now, number one, it has three-dimensional information encoded into it, which is highly unique. It's only 0.005 of an inch thick, just on the surface fibrils. It didn't rely on the shroud being in contact with the body. There's this image on the shroud where it couldn't possibly have been in contact with the body. This would indicate that whatever caused the image spanned at least 3 centimeters of space between them. So the best explanation for this is some type of radiation. But of course, what type of radiation is a big question, since there's nothing else that remotely resembles the shroud.
Unless maybe it's something supernatural.
Well, that of course is the strong implication. They also found that the reason the image on the shroud is so sharp is because whatever formed the image was what we call vertically collimated. That is, it all goes in right angles up and down from the body. And so radiation, by definition, goes in all directions, so that whatever this was a highly unusual type of radiation. Actually, fairly early in our research, we got intrigued by the observation of another researcher that there are apparently images of coins over the eyes. And a researcher in Chicago, Dr. Frank Filas, was both a photographer as well as an early shroud researcher as well as professor of theology, had noticed these images, and a numismatist, a coin expert who was working with him, had identified these as several Greek letters.
Now, there are Greek letters actually on the coins themselves there.
Yes, right. That's on the coins.
And I think people have to understand that you had some great pictures. They were actually taken in, 1931?
Yes, right.
And they were a tremendous definition. So you were able to actually to blow these up and get really an excellent definition on so many of the things there from these very, very old photographs.
Yes, right. We're very fortunate in having about 30 of these extremely high-grade photographs of the shroud was out in 1931, and it was photographed at that time also. Dr. Filas had speculated, as that several investigators were looking at this, and they noticed that there's also a thing that looked like a shepherd's crook. And so one of the people said, well, he knew of a coin that had that on it, which happened to be the lepton or the widow's mite of Pontius Pilate, and be struck in Israel at the time of Jesus.
And so
Dr. Paz had gotten several of these coins. He'd just given one of them. And it had a peculiar misspelling on it, which he saw on the shroud. It was about that time that my wife and I developed an optical analysis technique by which we project one image on top of the other. And I contacted Dr. Filas, who was pleased to find somebody took him seriously, as he'd been accused of hallucinating in the media. we contacted him that we had a technique by which we might be able to do very accurate comparative analysis. So he sent us photographs of his coin and studies he had done, and we found indeed that he was exactly right, that his coin was a dimate of the one that formed the image. And these are letters which are just, slightly over a millimeter, that's less than 1/8 of an inch in height. But they can be very clearly seen on the shroud.
And, of course, the amazing thing is that they had the ability to engrave, here we are 2,000 years ago, the mold that was used to mint these coins 2,000 years ago with this, very definite, you can actually see the letters there. And
exactly.
Actually, the letters were misspelled, though.
Yes, right. There was a misspelling. There was that the There's the coin. You can read part of the letters for Tiberius Caesar. Well, it's abbreviated, and the fellow who cut the die misspelled Caesar, as he spelled it with a C instead of the usual K, and which was very unusual. But we found when we projected it that we call what are points of congruence. As when we analyze an image, there are similar features we call points of congruence. And we actually were able to count about 185 points of congruence between these. And the characteristic of this was what's called coronal discharge or electrostatic discharge, which this is static electricity, or as many people are aware of it by if they shuffle across the carpet and that sort of thing in the wintertime, this snap they get off their fingers static electricity. But that type of current can make this type of image, and the image was characteristic of this. And so that gave us the first real clue directly from the shroud that there was some type of electrostatic imaging which was forming the image. So that gave us a clue that that was the case. Well, some years later, about 1991, I used a different technique for analyzing the image, putting the positive and negative image of the face on top of each other, and then when we throw it slightly out of alignment, it gives an incredible three-dimensional image. And so that when I did that, actually I did it with the hands first, and I saw that there were obviously bones visible on the shroud. And so the same thing was true for the face also. And the shroud shows a number of the skeletal features quite clearly. When you project it correctly, and so that this would indicate that the image was formed by some type of extra radiation coming out of the depth of the body and electrostatic or coronal imaging coming off the surface of the body. So, this is a totally unique phenomenon.
Well, no, I think there were so many things. First of all, these coins, and of course, apparently in certain cultures, they put coins over the eyes to keep the eyelids closed. Wasn't that what
Yes, right. That is that the Greeks, for instance, would often put coins in the person's mouth, as that they thought that this was, sort of a tip for the departed soul to give to Charon, who was supposed to row them across the river Styx so he wouldn't throw them overboard in the middle of the river. But as the Jews didn't believe in that, but two things were always done at the time of death among Jews, and this is they would tie the chin shut and they would close the eyelids. And if the person happened to die with the eyes open, the eyes, if you close them, frequently open up again. And so, we think that simply to keep the eyelids shut, they put the coins on them.
All right, but of course the interesting thing is that these coins that are there over the eyes actually date back to the time of Pontius Pilate. Coins are very, very distinctive, and they tell a tremendous historical story.
Yes, right. Well, not only that, they both of them were struck in 29 A.D.
Right.
So this is the shroud is doubly self-dating by the presence of identifiable coins over the eyes.
And then, of course, noted that there were a picture drawn of Jesus somewhere in the, 4th or 5th century, and you feel that the artist probably had a chance to see this picture on the shroud because of the similarity between the face that was drawn and, of course, the picture on the shroud.
Yes, right. Well, actually, we traced it back far further than that. Is that actually the shroud face is the most intensely and frequently copied image in history, and it had a massive impact on people who've seen it because the history of the shroud is fairly well known, fairly well documented. It was quite complex, but the shroud was folded up and sent up to the city of Edessa in 30 A.D. Mainly get it out of Jerusalem, and where either the Romans or the Jewish authorities would have destroyed it, of course, if they'd gotten a hold of it. So it was sent up to the to King Abgar, who was in Edessa, that was about 400 miles north of Jerusalem. And interestingly, that's the reason that it was sent up there is because Abgar had contracted leprosy. Of course, at that time, leprosy was a sentence worse than death. And so that Abgar had heard about the healer, named Jesus, down in Israel, so he had send a letter down, as in the Orthodox churches, they have the repeated correspondence between Abgar, your copies of it, between Abgar and Jesus, where Abgar is inviting Jesus to come up to heal him. But Jesus repeatedly replied, saying that he had to finish his work in Israel, but he would send one of his disciples up to heal him. And historically, this is in Eusebius, the early church history, Thaddeus was probably a Jewish zealot, carried the shroud, folded up so that only the face showed, carried this up to Abgar, who was miraculously healed of his leprosy, and declared himself and his city to be Christian. So actually, Edessa was the first Christian city. And so Abgar put a copy of the shroud face over the main gate of his city. There's that Edessa was one of the walled cities on the trade routes in the Far East of the Mediterranean, and all the traders and tourists and everybody had to stop and worship this image before they come in the city. And over the face it said, Christ the God, he who trusts in him will not be disappointed. So the shroud face was on public display in 30 A.D., and it had a massive impact on not people seeing it, but on other artwork and other divinities, because down in Dura-Ropis, which is a closely related city somewhat south of Edessa, there's a dated statue. It's actually Zeus Kyrios, but it's a dated statue. The first example of what's called frontality in art, which is obviously based on the shroud. It's basically the face that derived from the shroud, and this statue is dated 31 A.D. So obviously the image was known in as early as 31 A.D. and it was having a massive impact on artistic expressions from Rome to India in the first century.
Now where was that picture drawn that you have in the book?
Okay, well actually the one of Zeus Kyrios, it's in the Yale Art Gallery up in New Haven. I've seen it as with a foot of it. Now, I photographed myself. The face on it. It's a three-dimensional statuary.
But of course, you have this other picture that of the icon. Courtesy of St. Catherine's Monastery.
Yes, right.
What is that
right.
picture
so that,
from?
That's actually the one that got our serious research started. That is that the back in 1978, there was a lot of information coming out about the shroud, because of the study, and they've been on public display. But the question back then, is unfortunately, continues to be for many people, is how old is the shroud? Because, there are lots of artistic copies and this sort of thing made during the Middle Ages. And the question was this medieval artistic production, or was it ancient, even possibly the authentic burial shroud of Christ? And I'd seen it in 1977, but it was of interest, but I wasn't particularly involved. But one of my colleagues here at Duke was doing research out of St. Catherine's Monastery, which is in the Sinai Desert. And St. Catherine's is an intact 6th century church, and it's the treasure house of early Christian icons and manuscripts. And their prize icon is called Christ Pantocrator. It's an incredible icon. It was actually produced in about 550 A.D. And so that my friend asked, so struck by this. Well, he was reading the manuscripts. That was his main interest. But one of the monks showed him this icon, and he asked the monk, he was so struck, he asked the monk where it came from. The monk said, that's painted from the Shroud of Turin. And so when Jim came back, I told him that we had a casual interest in the Shroud, and so he brought back the photographs and this very interesting story, which immediately challenged us. You'd find out whether the monk's story was correct or not, because if it were, and since it was made in 550 A.D., if the monk's story was correct, obviously the shroud had to be around at that time if they're going to go painting it. Well, it turned out that icon is incredibly accurate to the shroud. And so that the detail in it, which shows even the flowers and this sort of thing, which we've recently rediscovered on the shroud, are accurately depicted in that icon. So that this shows that they had access to it. They believed it was authentic because they're using it as the basis of their icons.
And then, of course, you show that there are coins that were struck with the face of Christ on them.
Yeah, exactly.
And
right.
Of course, the picture, and for our listeners out there, of course, because Dr. Wanger is a into photography, they sort of devised a system of analyzing facial features, and just as for instance, when you look at a fingerprint, and you have to have 10 or 12 points to verify that it's the same fingerprint. Well, you came up with a system of 100, 150, or 200 points on a picture. How does that work?
Right. Well, this is our technique is not quite the same as the comparing the fingerprints, but that's basically what we use. I've asked a number of statisticians how you statistically determine the accuracy of that, and they're kind of at loss. So I use the forensic criteria. There's 14 points of congruence to determine similarity, the fingerprints are the same, and 45 to 60 points of congruence to determine that the face. Two facial images are basically the same individual.
And of course, this is what the government is increasingly doing, taking pictures of people on the street.
Exactly.
And they're looking at these points.
They're just using they're using computers for doing the same thing that we were doing.
All right. So basically, here you have this picture that's painted from St. Catherine's Monastery there in the Sinai Desert in the 500s somewhere. And then when was this coin struck, and who struck it?
Okay, fine. This coin is the first one that depicts Jesus on it. It was struck in the Byzantine Empire, this in Constantinople, by Justinian II in 692. It was just struck during a 3-year period. And, it's a very striking, image. And I'd seen a photograph of this, and that's what got me kind of intrigued, thinking that might well be based on the shroud, and as it turned out, they're highly accurately based on the shroud, because even on some of these tiny coins, which the image is only 8 to 10 millimeters high, very accurate depictions based on the shroud face. And the reason for this is that these coins actually are religious icons. They're gold coins, circulating coins, but they're actually religious icons, and they're plainly labeled with in Greek. There's that they Jesus Christ, the King of Kings. So they obviously had access to the shroud face. They presumed to be authentic, and the reason for this incredible accuracy in these icons and the coins and so forth is that in the Orthodox Church, icons have the same status as Scripture. And so that they, since they had an image that they considered to be authentic, they called it the archaeopetos, or the image not made with hands, they obviously, used this image as the basis for their depictions. Because, say that's that they, since they were making an image of Jesus, they didn't dare deviate from the image that they had, no more than they would casually rewrite the Scriptures. So for that reason, we have these incredibly accurate images from the 6th and 7th centuries.
And see, this is really what's so fascinating. A lot of people say, the shroud didn't show up until about 1,000, somewhere in there. I've heard this many times in the past. And so, was it really older than 1,000 or 1,200? Well, of course, you very well dated this thing back to with the coins over the eyes at the time of Pontius Pilate. And then we find evidence that people had seen it and painted pictures from it and then made coins from it. So this has really been the center of Christendom, or much of the Christian belief, down through the ages, long before 1,000.
Oh, yes, right. That's that the... of course, it's been speculated, but they did a carbon dating in 1988. Unfortunately, they totally botched the study, which had been set up, a good protocol had been set up, which the reasons, unknown but rather suspicious, were completely junked, and they only took a single specimen from the worst possible place on the shroud, and as it turned out, an area which was mostly rewoven in the 16th century. But they came up with a date of, that the shroud was made between 1260 and 1390.
Why would they take it from a rewoven area unless, of course, they specifically wanted to come up with a false conclusion?
Well, it's a little hard to give give an answer to that. It's highly suspicious why, when they were told, that they were supposed to take the 7 specimens from 7 places, carefully study them before they did the test, carbon dating, which would have made a pretty good protocol. They took one specimen. They cut 3 pieces off of it, so 3 labs did the same test on the same specimen. And we don't disagree that they correctly determined the amount of carbon-14 in the specimen, but we suspected, as soon as we saw the videos of them taking it. But we were appalled when they heard where they took it from, and when we saw the videos of them taking it, it was apparent to us that there were a lot of, extraneous threads running through this specimen. And as it turned out, actually it's been restudied. That's that the original threads and the original photographs that were then restudied just within the past year have shown that much of the material that they actually did the carbon dating on was this part that was rewoven in the 16th century. So, so they carbon dated a combination of 1st century and 16th century material, which, actually the proportion that they tested would produce a date from the 13th and 14th century, which is what they got. But anyway, that was, the media has been rather hostile to the shroud, and that information went worldwide. So that the idea was widely propagated that shroud was obviously a medieval fake since carbon dated to then. But we knew better than that since we had long before that been able to date the shroud to the spring of 30 A.D. in the Middle East.
All right. Well, of course, many people are sitting within the Catholic Church. This is an icon. They sort of really base their belief on many of the icons. You, I sure, really interested in this as a Protestant, purely from the scientific point of view, and because, verifying that this indeed, in all probability, was the shroud that our Lord was wrapped in after his death. And there were just so many things about, the blood there from the crown of thorns and the wound in the side. And would you like to go into all the details of the things that are actually can be seen on the shroud, the point of the fact that it verifies the biblical story?
Exactly. There's the information is absolutely incredible. Is that we found a large number of things with the coins. As of course the body image, the front and back of the obviously crucified Jewish male is the prime feature. But we were able to find not only the coins over the eyes, but there are two desecrated phylacteries. These are the Jewish prayer boxes, which clearly identified this person as a Jew, since nobody Jew would ever wear a phylactery. Also, there's that we were able to identify an amulet of Tiberius Caesar hanging around the neck with the Jewish tassels hanging from it, an absolutely outrageous thing, which is obviously an act of mockery. Then we've been able to identify the crown of thorns on the shroud, as the actual crown is on the right anatomic shoulder. So that we've seen that, and we've also found the image of one of the crucifixion nails is quite clear. We think we've seen two others, but they're only partial. And the image of a Roman spear, which fits the wound in the side, and then the sponge on a reed, we found also. But also there's a pair of sandals which fit the feet that's in it. The hammer that drove the nails in is on there. There are two scourges visible on the shroud. And a image of the dice, so we can only see one and a half of them, since part of them are in one of the burn marks that we see on the shroud. But if this doesn't convince anyone that they're and something else which is extremely important, there are flower images, hundreds of flower images on the shroud.
Now we'll get back to all these things in just a few minutes, and of course we'll welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We'll ask Jerry just to hang on there in Los Angeles until we get back from this break. And of course, remember, if you'd like to call us, our number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we sincerely hope many of you will seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours every day, 5 hours on the radio, 5 hours on the Internet, 3 hours on satellite, 2 hours on shortwave. Our weekend program is heard on 35 or more stations. But, of course, we depend upon you and your help to continue doing what we're doing, reaching out across America with the news behind the news, the story behind the story. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, why give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, of course, our number, again, is 1-800-544-8927. I probably want to get the December newsletter, which goes into the occult history of our monetary system. And people are going to say, occult history of the monetary system? What are you talking about? And I simply ask you to get the letter, to read it, and evaluate what we're saying. Do you really understand our monetary system? Because almost everything in our society evolves around money. What was it? Money is the root of all evil. I think that comes of one of the Proverbs. But it's important you understand money and its foundation, and of course what's happening to our monetary system, and how that fits into the spiritual battle that's being waged in our society today. So if you'd like to get a copy, you'd have to specifically request the December newsletter. It's going out very soon if you're a subscriber, but otherwise we'd be glad to send you one free of charge if you haven't had one before. Remember, you can go to our website at www.radioliberty.com. You can listen to our programs there, really 5 hours every day. Not get anything accomplished at all, but you can listen if you want to. But, of course, if you just listen maybe 1 or 2 hours a day, hopefully with time you'll begin to understand what we're talking about. That eternal spiritual battle that began in the Garden of Eden that is being acted and played out today before our very eyes. So if you'd like to get in touch with us, remember our number 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America truly is at war and under attack today. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and right now we have Jerry calling in from Los Angeles. Hi, Jerry. Did you have a question or comment?
Hi. Well, you answered my question. I was going off the line then. And, part about the carbon dating being from the 1300s is really just the part of the shroud that was repaired about the same time. So it's not the actual shroud that they've carbon dated.
No, and they for one reason or another they did not do an accurate analysis, and you'll have to wonder why they would have done that. But you know, Jerry, there are people out there who really would try to do anything they can to destroy the concept that the story of the crucifixion, the story of our Lord, is false, and they will do anything they can to try to get that idea across.
But, you know, a couple of interesting things that, you know, I've heard another program on this issue, on the shroud, and one issue was really interesting is that the shroud, well, the person on the shroud looks, you know, I don't know how they figured this out, but this person approached it from a non-religious point of view, and he said the person in the image in the shroud is of a person floating. Have you heard that?
Well, let's get Dr. Wanger's impression.
I know that thought. There's that the you know the one that's putting forth that idea thought that the shroud showed Jesus ascending. He based that on the fact that you can see the hair along the side of the face. And I was sort of presuming that since the body would have been laying flat on its back, that the hair would have fallen back. But I don't think that's the case, because there was the chin band on. If you look at the shroud face, you see that there are spaces, apparent spaces on both sides of the face and around through the beard. This is where the chin band is, and Jesus had long hair. He was a Nazarene, and undoubtedly had long hair, these forelocks. And they would be sweaty and bloody and held forward by his paws, so that we see them. But that doesn't mean that Jesus was upright. Is that the? I don't think it was floating. I think that the evidence indicates that the body dematerialized in a tenth of a second or less, with this release of this whatever this radiation is to produce the image. Very interestingly, I didn't quite finish about the flowers, but this is very interesting and important. because we've been able to identify about 20 varieties of these, we've worked with the leading authority on the botany of Israel. He's been working with us for 5 years now. He says that the only place that you could find these particular collection of flowers is in the immediate vicinity of Jerusalem. The common blooming time of these flowers is March and April. And actually, we can tell by the images on the shroud that the image was formed sometime approximately 30 hours after the death of the individual.
And of course,
the shroud gives us incredible information.
And of course, that the Passover ordinarily is in April, isn't it?
Yes, right.
All right, fine. Anything else you wanted to say, Jerry?
Oh, I just wanted to mention that science is not able to reproduce the image on the shroud because it's not just a surface picture as you might expect it. You know, it seems to run through the entire fabric of the shroud itself, and science can't reproduce that. So we can't reproduce it now. How did they do it, 500 years ago?
Or how did they do it maybe 2,000 years ago? And maybe, Jerry, this is the shroud, and maybe, of course, this is a supernatural event. Okay, thanks so much for calling. And, of course, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Our speaking with, of course, Dr. Alan Wenger, The Shroud of Turin, An Adventure of Discovery. How can people get copies of your book?
All right, fine. Actually, we have a website. Our approach is, for people to look at the evidence for themselves. So we have an interactive website. Where people can do our overlay technique for themselves, so they can take a look at the coin images and so forth. They can see a number of the flower images and so forth that we see on them. It also lists where our book is available. My wife and I have written a book, which basically we call it The Shroud of Turin, The Adventure of Discovery, which tells the story of our findings, how we got involved, and many of the findings that we've been privileged to make. We've been rather intensely involved in this. We wonder why we keep finding all these things, but if the Lord keeps showing them, we'll keep looking. So we've been able to find these things. But our book is available either from Amazon or contact us. Our website address is on there.
We can
send it ourselves.
What is the website?
You can get to Amazon or Noble, Barnes & Noble.
Oh, okay, Barnes & Noble. What's your website?
Okay, fine. It's www.shroudcouncil.org.
All right, fine. That's www.shrinecouncil.org.
Shroudcouncil.org.
Okay. S-H-R-O-U-D?
Right.
Shroudcouncil.org.
Right.
And, of course, this is a fascinating book. I sort of follow your things. Now, what was this about the bones and the hand? And you have some pictures that you actually sent me with this, and you can actually see... You have a hand that you've overlaid the picture that was on the shroud. What was the significance of that?
All right, fine. That's most interesting because the question came up because on the shroud it looks like the fingers are very long. There have been a number of speculations about why that was. I mean, including Marfan syndrome and some other rather exotic things. Since we had found early on that we were getting coronal discharge, which comes off the surface of the body, I thought we were seeing the tendons on the back of the hand, which made it sort of look long. Although my wife said early on, those look like bones to her, and I said, look, I'm the surgeon, those are the tendons. Until a number of years later when we did this overlay of positive-negative images, and I threw my line, was quite obvious that we were seeing the bones in the hand. The comparison we're making is with a specimen that was done by a French surgeon back in the 1930s. This was a Dr. Barbet. He was convinced that the shroud was authentic, and he was doing some research into crucifixion. He was using an amputated arm, and he put a nail, there's a spike, through the only place you can put a nail through the wrist without breaking anything. It's called a space adesto. That's on the small finger side of the wrist. And so he put a nail through there. Well, actually, we were able to overlay his X-ray of this specimen on the shroud hand, and we can actually see, you know, we can identify the wrist bones on the shroud, and right where the nail went through, there's a gap in the bones. Because putting, a half-inch spike, which is about the size of the nail was used, through the wrist would tear the ligaments, and since it wasn't taken out till after death, well, the wound didn't really close up very much. And so we can actually see on the shroud, not only the skeletal system, but we can see clearly how the crucifixion took place.
And, of course, here we are now, looking back over 2,000 years, we find the figure of a man who is somehow rather dematerialized and left an image implanted on linen. This linen has existed for 2,000 years. It's been cared for, and I think at one time, didn't they have a fire there? And
yes, right. The reason, some people tried to burn it up back in 1532. They set fire to the chapel that was in, and the fire melted one corner of the silver box that the shroud was in, and it dripped molten silver down through the folded shroud and produced both burned holes through as well as made big scorch marks that run the full length of it. That's a rather prominent feature. It doesn't have anything to do with the original image, but actually it helped to show that the image is not an artistic production of any sort. And then just to show that, the people and forces out trying to destroy this image, there was another attempt at arson back in 1997. They totally burned up the chapel in which the shroud was ordinarily kept, but fortunately it happened to be out of the chapel and they escaped any further damage.
Well, now, was there a face cloth that had similar markings on it?
Exactly. This is another thing that intrigued us, is that they, in the scripture, there's, a lot of people think, this hadn't got into a scripture. Well, the gospel, all four of the gospels mentioned the shroud, but John 20 is particularly informative of this because it describes John and Peter going to the tomb, and just to quote, this is John 20, 6 and 7, Peter therefore also came following him, entered the tomb, and he beheld the linen wrappings lying there, and the face cloth which had been on his head, not lying with linen wrappings, but rolled up in its place by itself. Then the next one, as we think is very important, this is so the other disciple who had first come to the tomb entered then also, and he saw and believed, which we think is extremely important, a testimony to the shroud. It doesn't say, what he saw. A lot of people say, that was because the tomb was empty. Well, the tomb wasn't empty. It happened to have the shroud in it. It's our speculation that John, kind of looked in the shroud and saw the image on it, which he recognized and knew perfectly well that this was no ordinary event.
Well,
so John, in a sense, became a believer right in the tomb. So we think that this is a considerable interest, and actually gives part of the reason for what we think is the reason, the shroud was made and has been preserved in spite of attempts to debunk it and destroy it. Because later in the same chapter 20, it talks about a certain disciple by the name of Thomas who wanted some evidence. Thomas was a sort of skeptic or scientist at the time, and he wanted to see some evidence before he was going to believe it. This is really Jesus. And it's important to remember that Jesus didn't zap him for his wanting to see evidence. He showed him, said, here are the wounds in my wrist and the wound in my side. Come and take a look. Or, put your finger in them. So that, we think that the shroud was left as a witness to skeptics those who are, wondering or doubting. Is to the evidence that indeed this is that Jesus was a reality, and that he left this incredible witness of the shroud to the events of the suffering, the crucifixion, his death, and the resurrection.
Well, of course, now the phylactery there, you can see that, and you have all these wonderful, wonderful pictures here in your book. Now, one of the things, of course, I wondered is why did they leave the pictures of a hammer, of a nail, and why did they leave the pictures of the flowers there? What was their significance?
Okay, fine. By Jewish custom, there's a lot of people wonder that, particularly, say, even since we got a Roman spear in there, which is absolutely unheard of, By Jewish custom, anything that was had the lifeblood on it was buried with the body, or anything that was in touch with the body at the time of death was buried with the body.
So that's why they would have buried the nail, they would have buried the hammer and the spear?
Certainly. Because, you know, of course, the nail was, you know, had been driven through the wrist. The hammer was undoubtedly kind of splattered with blood, you know, driving the nails in. The spear, of course, you know, was the one that pierced the side. And, you know, so that we think that, in a sense, it's amazing that they're on there, but it's quite logical. Well, this, of course, is not only no ordinary death, this is no ordinary burial.
And this is no ordinary shroud. I mean, there are lots of shrouds around, but nothing quite like this.
Absolutely not.
And, of course, the thing is that if Jesus dematerialized, or these other things could have just as easily been dematerialized and left the imprint on this shroud for others to see. Now, most people have never even, most investigators haven't found these items that you have they?
Many have seen them. Many have never really looked. Or there's a problem. You have to understand the nature of the image, and you have to have good photographs, because the image on the shroud, as you directly see it, is very faint. And one concern that we have is that it's getting fainter all the time, mainly because the shroud is yellowing, and since the image originally was faint yellow anyway, it's basically being swallowed up. So that the image was obviously much clearer in earlier centuries than it is now. But the 1931 photographs are extraordinarily good. They enhance the image. And we have photographically and also computer-wise enhanced the images, which enable us to find these. But, you know, there's still a lot of people have seen these. They're on the Internet, and, you know, tens of thousands of people have seen them. They're radiation images. They are faint. They're partial. They're embedded. There's, you know, there are all kinds of images, you know, and spots and things on the shroud. And if you're not used to looking at these, it's often very difficult to see them. But this is why our overlay technique is helpful, because then you can do a direct comparison with actual objects, and can see what the image is composed of. But you know, this is so a number of people, you know, they have trouble seeing this, and they, you know, some just go look at a photograph of the shroud. They don't immediately see what we're talking about, so they discount it. There's that problem. But there's also the considerable problem that a number of people don't want to see these things. I've had people come here, and this is one fellow who writes a lot about the shroud. Yeah, I mean, he was sitting here, and he's been a skeptic all along. He's on three different occasions has seen the flower images, and then later has denied that they were on there. You know, here, and I sat him down in front of some of our photographs and pointed these out, and he kept saying, "Yes, I see what you're talking about, but I don't accept that." Well, I mean, he was seeing what we're talking about. He just, he wouldn't accept it. And you know, I can't make him accept it, but he can see what we were talking about.
Well, now of course you assume then that all these flowers were placed under the shroud or adjacent to Jesus as he lay on the shroud, and that's where all the flowers came from.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. There's that they were. We think the reason for that. Many of these are bouquets and that type of thing. Some of them are the burial spices. So, you know, the spices were not necessarily, you know, ointments and powders. Some of them were actually dried and intact plants. Most of these, we think, were funerary, flowers put in. You know, just the same as we use flowers these days. You know, there's at the time of sorrow and grief, you know, it's kind of a measure of, you know, of hope and consolation to use flowers. So we think that, you know, these flowers, were, you know, many of them were just gathered by the roadside. On the way to the tomb, and were put in by the family and the loved ones to honor Jesus.
Well, now of course, as I look at the picture, I see the shape of the frontal face, and then to either side, I see these vertical white lines, and then there are these black triangles. What is that all about?
Right next to the face.
Well, basically, there are these white lines, and then there are these intermediate things in it.
All right. Those white lines are actually folds on the shroud.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Right. So that you're looking at three-dimensional images. We separated them, and so you actually see both the positive and negative, both the white and the dark line on that. But those are wrinkles on the shroud.
Okay, fine. So when we look at it, but you can actually see the figure here. Of course you can't see the eyes because they're covered. You can see the chin strap on it. It's just amazing technology. The hands crossed, over the pubic area, the legs. And then, of course, all of these other things are here. Your findings, are they pretty well accepted by other scientists, or many of them are challenged?
We got a mixed reaction, which we have from the beginning. As I say, our approach is basically look at the evidence and make up your own mind, but at least look at the good evidence, that's why we say this, that the. You should look at the best available photographs and make sure that they're enhanced. It's important to recognize that they're radiation images because people are not used to looking at this type of image. We're not used to looking at things in the negative and the peculiar features that we see in radiation images. Interestingly, among a lot of people, we've had thousands of people who have seen our work directly, as well as large numbers in major presentations we made, and of course on the internet and so forth, and it's been on television a number of occasions. So a lot of people have seen this, but we've found that the people who can spot these images most quickly are artists and physicians. I got to wonder about that, but. I think this is because I think artists have a probably almost a innate capacity for perceiving detail and this type of thing in images. And I suspect it's probably because physicians are trained have various degrees of training in radiology and are used to looking at shadowy images and interpreting them. So that it depends on the group. Interestingly, that is that in many adult groups, I've taken some brief surveys. Usually, about when I point out the images on some of our directly on some of our photographs, about 50% of them can spot the flower images, or at least some of them. Interestingly, and talking with the groups of very young people, as in early adolescence, about 80-90% of them can see them, and I've even had 7-year-olds correctly identify some of the flowers. So that it varies greatly in people's capacity to see these things, but many people just plain have difficulty seeing them.
Well, there's another thing, and that thing is that if you believe that Jesus Christ lived and was crucified and died and was resurrected, you're probably much more prone to see this than if you're looking at it from exactly the opposite point of view. There are people who have different world visions.
Exactly.
We look at the world differently, and you look at the world differently. Two people can look at the same glass of water. Some people say it's half empty. Some people say it's half full. Some people can look at abortion, and they say, we're against abortion, but and they can give you all the reasons why abortion's good. Then, if you look at it from the Christian point of view, abortion's bad. And the same thing would be looking at that shroud. You see there, you would see things that other people wouldn't see because you have a different worldview because you believe in the shroud, and with good justification, I think. After reading your book, I think it's exciting the things you've uncovered.
Right. Well, we try to be as objective as we can about this. We don't see them just because we believe in it. We believe in it because we've seen these things.
But I think that people could be there and people would not see them.
Oh yes, right. Because when people have trouble seeing this, well, I can empathize with them because I've been I've spent nearly 25 years studying these photographs for thousands of hours, going over them, fraction of an inch by fraction of an inch, as well as in the gross detail, and that we've continued just to find things from time to time, which have been there all the time. But I didn't see them, although so I've been studying this for all these years. So it's I sometimes kind of forget that you know, they're fairly obvious to us now because we know what where they are and what they are. But that just people who look at this for the first time, you know, it's often rather confusing.
Well, I want to congratulate you and your wife on your dedication to this work, and you know, I think that you've really done a Herculean job, and you've really contributed greatly to my knowledge of the shroud, and I'm sure to the knowledge of millions of other people. I was just surprised; I'd never heard of you until one of my friends mentioned your work, and I'm really so glad we were able to get you on. I hope we can get you on to some of our other programs.
Well, thank you. I certainly would like to do that because we think the shroud has an important message for a lot of people.
What is that message?
I think you know, for someone said that you know, a true believer that doesn't need evidence, is that the true skeptic that doesn't want the evidence, and so there are a lot of people in between who are sort of wondering about it, and would like to know about you know, about this Jesus and what happened, and was he real, and what was the resurrection possibly like, and this sort of thing. I think the shroud is an incredible witness that you know, obviously was very deliberately designed by someone who knows how to take molecules apart and put them together, you know, as a witness to you know, to succeeding generations. And it's also interesting that the shroud really couldn't be understood until till this generation, because it's only with you know, very detailed scientific study and very specialized tests and this sort of thing that you can really appreciate what's on the shroud.
You know, we have so many opportunities now to prove you know, beyond any shadow of a doubt the biblical story. And yet still men will disbelieve.
Right. Well this is the case, to say, well, this is somewhat the same, but, you know, we don't mind doubters because, you know, doubters are looking for answers, but skeptics don't want the answers.
Amen to that.
So there are many skeptics in the media. That's where I'm battling right now. There's, you know, numerous attempts to debunk the shroud and make the serious shroud researchers look like a bunch of, you know, clowns.
Well, you won't get that that response from me, and we will get you on our other programs. If we're out of time. God bless you. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Fine, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was Dr. Wanger, and I hope you enjoyed our program. And his book is really fascinating. It's called The Shroud of Turin, An Adventure of Discovery. And, of course, we can always get it for you, but you can get it from Amazon.com. We haven't decided to carry it yet. It's a good book, though. I recommend it to you. And it will be back in just a moment with the main of our program. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. But please hold your calls for a few minutes. Right now, we're trying to get Randy Thomason on the line to tell us what's going on up there in Sacramento, where the governor is struggling with a $35 billion deficit, and see what's going to happen and see what's happening as far as the new legislature is concerned. Then, of course, we'll go to Brad Dacus for his analysis of the current attack on Christianity. And lastly, we'll have our good friend John Leffler on. But right now, let's go to Randy Thomason. Hi, Randy. How are things going up in Sacramento?
Hi, Dr. Stan. Well, it's a busy week up here. Hey, courageous New Year to you.
Well, now what's happening? We understand the governor has announced that there's not going to be any problem at all with that $35 billion deficit. He's just going to take care of this with a cool efficiency.
Well, it seems to be a blame game here. When you look at the Davis, who has grown the size of government about 40%, you know, he's the guy who spent when the money was coming in, and then when some of the dot-coms went belly up and changes in the stock market and so forth, he's blaming the economy, not his wild spending habits. So he's come out with a new deal to say that if he's going to try to basically put together new jobs for Californians.
We've lost 230,000 jobs here in California. Where is he going to get the new jobs from?
Well, it's talking about money from the federal government, also a bond-funded project. That's a slow form of taxes. So he's basically going to promote more big government through this way.
Well, now, wait a minute. Are these the bond issues that we've already voted in, or are these new bond
issues? These are bond issues of the past, yeah. Uh-huh. He's going to accelerate them. But again, I see this as more the cover story. He did a cover story, a sham budget last year. It was a total sham budget, which just was like moving the deck chairs in the Titanic. It didn't really change anything. The numbers are looking very bad, about a $35 billion deficit. And again, who's to blame? He is pointing the finger without saying so, but at others. He's allowing himself to do the wild spending of the past. He wants to do some moderate cuts, but it's certainly not enough. Of course, you can't trust a liberal to do what's right in terms of money. They want to spend instead of cut. And Ray Davis is saying, hey, basically, it's the economy. There aren't enough jobs. Well, of course, there are jobs. There were more jobs when there wasn't as much tax and spend bureaucracy that are running jobs out of the state. I mean, businesses are leaving the state for Oregon and for Arizona and Nevada. There was just another article in the newspaper today about with the businesses of the state are considering packing up and leaving more of them because of what they see coming down the pike. So it's hard to do business in California. I've got farmer friends who are squirming because of the new regulations on them. Doctor friends who are saying it's so hard to be a doctor. You know that, Dr. Stan. It's very difficult.
All right, fine. Well, now, what about the legislation dealing with family values?
Well, there is going to be a continuing attacks upon marriage, and the newest revelation comes out of the Bay Area Reporter, which is a homosexual newspaper, and it says, look, here's the strategy. Instead of shooting for civil unions this year, the homosexual legislators, there are five of them, have put together a plan to stuff all the rights of marriage into a domestic partners bill. And so they're afraid to use the term gay marriage or homosexual marriage, and now they're increasingly afraid to use the phrase civil unions because that became a hot potato issue for Gray Davis last year, And Gray Davis experienced some political angst about that. He said he was going to found a task force to study, quote-unquote, how to bring civil unions to California. And then under some pressure, he abandoned those plans. And so now the in all their, quote, wisdom, the homosexual legislators are saying, let's go for a domestic partners plan. But you know what? If it stinks under one label, it's going to stink under a second label. This is a bold-faced attack against marriage. There's a bill that's going to be introduced. It has no number yet, but it's going to be introduced by Assemblywoman Jackie Goldberg of Los Angeles. She's a very left-leaning lesbian Democrat. And so that's expected to come down the pike. It's going to be one of the largest battles for families this year.
You know, I think that God is going to take his vengeance on this state. I really do. I hate to say that, but certainly the people have allowed five people of flaunting their perversion on this state. You know, if somebody wants to be a homosexual, I don't agree with them. But, you know, when you're coming out of the closet and you're pushing this agenda and the people of this state have supported it, there's going to be consequences.
Well, there are, because the homosexual agenda is certainly not civilized. You remember, Dr. Stan, 30 years ago, they were saying, well, we want to have live and let live. I mean, we heard a lot of that, right? And now it's really no longer that. The homosexual activists and the homosexual activist groups are not willing to let marriage be what it is. They're not willing to let the Boy Scouts be what they are.
And they won't even allow a judge who belongs to a church that says homosexuality is wrong sit on the bench. And I will tell you that the Sodom and Gomorrah were never like we are in California. And I really believe that we're going to see some dramatic tragedies in this state in the next several years. I believe we're entering a period of chaos and crisis. And, you know, if we have a just God, why should we not expect it? And as Thomas Jefferson said, I tremble for my country when I reflect God is just and his justice cannot sleep forever.
So all of us need to, basically, with whatever problems face us, we need to realize that we are part of the problem, we are part of the solution, and we need to pray and seek God for repentance. We need to pray that people will be convicted. I'm convinced that if all people of a biblical Christian faith, or even other faiths that uphold some basic moral values, if they voted correctly, we'd have different government. You know, what we're looking at is a lot of people who just don't really care about things, either voting wrongly by mistake or voting on purpose, but electing the people in power who are going to attack all those things that are virtuous. Dr. Sam, what we're really dealing with up here right now this week is whether we're going to have higher taxes or not. I think that the Democrats are really going to push for it up here. Gray Davis is saying that there's going to be, quote, hard choices. He hasn't used the T word yet, but tomorrow he delivers his State of the State speech, and then Friday he delivers his proposal for the budget. And I believe that we're going to see tax increases and cuts to programs, a combination, when we really need to see across-the-board spending cuts. Gray Davis is trying to make himself look balanced when it's really imbalanced to breathe life into something and then breathe death into it at the same time.
Well, would you like to get out your website and your telephone number, Randy?
Sure. We've got a great website. We'd love to have you visit. We put a lot of work into it, and it's basically for you to visit. And so please do so. Our website is www.savecalifornia.com. SaveCalifornia.com. Our new story right at the top of our website is the new state legislature. Get to know who your legislators are. We've got a whole new listing of who they are and how to get in touch with them and whether they've signed the marriage protection pledge. Each one of you has a state assembly member and a state senator, and you ought to visit SaveCalifornia.com. And also at our website, please sign up for free email updates. We'd really love to give you that. And so that's basically what I have to say, and it's just a sincere invitation.
All right, bye-bye, and we'll talk to you next week.
All right, Dr. Sam.
Bye-bye. Okay, and we've got Brad Dacus on the line here. Hi, Brad. How are we doing?
Oh, doing just great.
Now, of course, Brad is from the Pacific Justice Institute, and he is, of course, on the front lines of the legal battle. So are we winning or losing?
Oh, well, this is a win but a challenge.
Oh, boy.
We have there's two OBGYN doctors who are Christians who are committed to their conviction, and they had a patient who was a lesbian who wanted to be fertilized, and they didn't even object to intravaginal fertilization, but they did have a problem with intrauterine fertilization because that went beyond the basic boundaries of the traditional process. So these workers said, hey, no, these doctors said, hey, look, you're going to have to go somewhere else. Here's some other doctors, some other phone numbers you can call and refer her on. But she instead filed a lawsuit alleging sexual orientation-based discrimination against these two Christian doctors, OBGYNs, who were simply following their conscience. Well, the good news is the lower court agreed with the doctors. The bad news is that this lesbian plaintiff has filed an appeal to the California Fourth Appellate District, and we were contacted specifically by their lead counsel to weigh in and file a Title VII cause of action, basically an argument in the amicus brief, in order to go to bat for these doctors and make sure that their rights are protected. They don't have to choose between their faith and their ability to keep their job as a doctor.
Okay, well, that sounds great, and I'm glad you're out there looking after these issues because, of course, you know, there's nothing more intimidating than the court system, and nothing, of course, really, I think, more unjust than people being bankrupted just simply paying for their legal fees, and I know you take these cases on certainly without charge. So would you like to get your telephone number and your website out for our listeners?
Oh, you bet. We're, as you know, we're very actively involved in with lots of cases and not just watching but really litigating in many ways, and if people like to keep up with our cases and what we're doing, they can look at our web, get our free copies of our press release via email via our webpage, which is pacificjustice.org. That's pacificjustice.org. Or if they need help also, they can also call us at our toll-free number, which is 888-305-9129, 888-305-9129. And the bottom line here, Dr. Stanley, is that people who are working, who have faith, should never, ever have to choose between their ability to keep their faith and their ability to keep their employment or their profession, including doctors in America.
Well, God bless you. Thanks so very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. And let's just see. Who do we have here? Do we have John Leffler? Well, I guess we don't have John Leffler, so maybe we'll be getting John on the line in just a moment here. As you put John onto line six, please. And for those of you who don't know who John is, John, of course, is a talk show host. He has his own program. It's called Steel on Steel, certainly one of my favorite guests. And John is always kind enough to come on here. They only have a 40-minute program, but lots of interesting things. John has his ear to the ground, and certainly last week he called me and told me about the fact that in London, England, a wife had been called and by the gentleman who's an associate editor of I Spy magazine, and everybody over in England was very upset because, of course, the British government, Tony Blair's government, had called all the British ambassadors in the world home for an emergency meeting. Now, this has never happened before in all history. At least to my knowledge, and not to the knowledge of people over in Great Britain. Why not just give them a phone call? Why not send them a letter? Why not send them a coded message or something in a diplomatic pouch? Why bring all the ambassadors from Great Britain home for an emergency meeting? And what's the emergency about? Well, it's about the war with Iraq and the possibility of a biological or other terrorist attack on Great Britain. And then, of course, John couldn't really verify the story. It was just a rumor in England, except that later that day, of course, it appeared in the Associated Press. It was picked up by the Jerusalem Post. So there's something a great to this. And then John was commenting that we're seeing more and more UFO sightings all over the world. Hi, John. How are you doing tonight?
Hello, Dr. Stan.
Well, tell me, you almost leave us on the edge of our seats as if waiting for the other shoe to drop. What is this emergency meeting that's taking place in Great Britain? What is so important that they would bring all of the ambassadors home? And if there is something important, why aren't they telling British people? Why aren't they telling the American people? The article, apparently, in the Jerusalem Post, which is posted at cuttingedge.org website, said that this had to do with the possibility of a terrorist attack on Great Britain. Had you heard that?
No, I hadn't. The only thing, I saw it on Fox News this morning where they were talking about it and the meeting was starting, and they just sort of glossed over it. And we looked at each other and said, "This is amazing. This is a first in the history of Great Britain where they've actually called all of the ambassadors home for a meeting. I mean, this didn't even happen in World War II, you know." And suddenly everybody is going, "Well, why is that, for Pete's sake?" You know. So there's still no info on that. There's all sorts of stuff bubbling around everywhere. It's amazing now.
But of course, it's all bubbling, and of course, it's not coming to a crescendo. But you have that same feeling that I do, that we're sitting on the beach, we're looking out at the sky. It's blue, the waves are quiet, but we know that off the coast is a hurricane.
Yeah, something like that. And I think my analogy was the part, if you've ever been on a roller coaster like we've got up the road here, where they winch you up to the top for the first run, you know, it's not too bad as you're going up, but as soon as you go over the top, you're suddenly, it's a point of no return, you've made a commitment, that type of thing. That's sort of what I get the feeling, and what a lot of us are sort of intuiting, and we're trying to flesh it out, we're working hard on this, is that the war in Iraq is almost a sidebar. It's like about a fourth of the whole issue of everything going on. We know there's a lot of stuff brewing in Venezuela and the Caribbean right now. President Bush put out an executive order just recently in November, which basically deals with the issue of terrorism in the Caribbean. Now, you wouldn't think about that, except for the fact that what's been happening is, first of all, let's look at Venezuela. Venezuela is in, I don't know how to describe it, it's a basket case right now.
Well, but of course, what is our involvement in this whole thing? Is the CIA behind this uprising against the Chavez?
Well, that's the interesting part. That's what I've been trying to figure that out, because to tell you why, about 15 to 17% of our oil comes from Venezuela. An equivalent amount comes from Iraq. Now, if about, say, 30% of our supply of oil is cut off during the war, the country's going to be hard-pressed to even wage the war. Some of the oil, at least one oil company, we talked about it last week on the Financial Sense NewsHour, has put in a request to begin cutting into the critical supplies that are reserved for military purposes, because they can't deliver. Now, what's happening with Chavez is there's more to Chavez than this. He's looking for an excuse to basically overturn the constitution of Venezuela and get a full-blown dictatorship going. There is resistance among certain wings of the military to doing that. Ironically, this almost looks identical to the situation that it did way back when Salvador Allende in Chile was going to take the country down the very same road, and finally the junta headed up by Pinochet said, "Oh, no, you don't. We're not going down this road of Marxism." He was climbing in bed with Fidel Castro. And guess who? Hugo Chavez is meeting with 3 days a week now, according to Insight magazine. They both fly to an island out in the Caribbean, which is sort of a mutual distance. Chavez and Castro have been meeting, and then there are meetings also going on between Lula da Silva, who is the president of Brazil, a self-proclaimed Marxist, and Chavez and Castro. So these three have a sort of a pas de trois going. In addition to that, there is now emerging evidence that Chavez is providing terrorist bases and training for al-Qaeda terrorists and other related Muslim groups in Venezuela. And there's also bases now apparently in Trinidad and Tobago. So that's what's going on in the Caribbean. You're hearing very, very little about it. And I talked to Joe Douglas today just briefly about the whole issue. And he said, you know, what we really like, just knowing how this thing works, is as soon as we get involved in, say, Iraq, to see this whole terrorist thing just explode across our borders on coming up from the Caribbean and elsewhere. Let's face it, if we couldn't stop drugs from coming in, how are you going to stop anything else from coming in?
Well, have you are you acquainted with this article in the latest issue of Foreign Affairs magazine by Robert Britt, I believe is his name? And of course, he's a senior fellow, adjutant fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, Foreign Affairs being the theoretical journal of the Council on Foreign Relations. It's called us committing suicide from fear of death. And it's basically saying, look, If Saddam Hussein, is really a wicked man, and as soon as he gets, his weapons of mass destruction, which we think he has, he will attack us. But we don't know whether he has them, and he probably doesn't have at least the nuclear weapons at the present time, but we're convinced that, if once he gets those nuclear weapons, he's going to attack us. Why would we be surprised if, when we attack him and he knows he's going to lose and he's going to be killed, why would we be surprised if he would not attack us now? And, this idea of a preemptive war is like Bismarck had referred to committing suicide from fear of death. And he says, when Saddam is pushed to the wall, he's going to strike back, and we are doing everything to push him to the wall. Why aren't we warning the American people of the very real possibility of a terrorist attack? Now, and he goes on to say, I don't know whether it's going to happen or not, but certainly a lot points in that direction. And if there's even the vaguest possibility, we ought to be making preparations, and we're not. Now, we do know, of course, that back in Washington, D.C., they're building some sort of a bunker for Dick Cheney. Why aren't they building bunkers for other Americans?
Well, you could use this from, you could view this at several levels. One would be the incompetence level. I don't quite chalk it off like that. There's always been this among the globalist crowd, the need to bring the U.S. down to a third world country level. This has been frequently stated to make us more. This was the whole policy, if you recall, thanks to our socialist influence in the State Department during the whole Cold War, is basically, we have to make ourselves vulnerable so that peace can be maintained. This was always the rationalization, rather than saying, well, if we're super strong, peace will be definitely maintained, which seems to be the most reasonable way. Right now, we're even having trouble identifying our enemies or the fact that we're under attack. I just driving home here, I just walked in from, I do martial arts training during the week, and well, the first thing that you get instruction in is when you're in an attack situation, you have to recognize you're under attack. You have to actually clear that in your head and say, I don't care what I was doing 5 minutes ago, and I don't care what my life may be like 5 minutes from now. I must deal with this situation. And why people are attacking me, the liberals, they've almost been reduced to irrelevance. I don't know if you've noticed that after the speech today on, the economy is teeter-tottering, getting ready to just blow out. And President Bush, at least to his credit, to a certain degree, is at least trying to institute some tax cuts. They've got to do something, because we're headed that way, and as soon as they're over, well, along comes Geraldine Ferraro, and, tax cuts for the rich, tax cuts for the rich. And I keep thinking, Rome is burning, and these people are throwing gasoline on it. So that's pretty much the same deal we have here. Because of all of the years of political correctness, because of all the years when we were told, well, we all just have differing opinions, all cultures are the same, we shouldn't say that we're better. You know the whole shtick, right, Dr. Stan?
Right.
We actually right now, if you've noticed, the media are not behind any kind of defense of the country. To the liberal credit, they're upset about the fact that Bush is trashing the Constitution in certain areas, which I agree with, but they're upset about it for the wrong reasons.
And they want the wrong solution, right.
And they want the wrong solution, right. And I was thinking coming home tonight, it's interesting, I've been reading a lot this week trying to get ready for my radio show, and you watch all of the different factors all in place. It's the same thing you talked about. You're sitting on a clear day, it's a blue ocean, it's great to be in the surf there, and just off the horizon out of sight is a massive hurricane coming. We've got the bond market teeter-tottering. Gold is going to burst. It is just going to burst upwards through its holding levels, showing that the dollar is deteriorating even more. And we have another lawsuit going, from the Blanchard Company. We know that the government, our government, the British government, Canadian government have all been complicit in trying to artificially keep the price down of gold. So that's coming on. The bond market's teeter-tottering. Stock market will continue its slide. I don't care what President Bush said today. We're nowhere near the bottom on this thing. If we look at the oil situation, we are facing a cutoff of the oil supplies, and right now the refineries are running flat out. We have terrorism, new entrenched Marxism developing throughout Latin America, or at least in key countries like Venezuela and Brazil, and potential for terrorism coming across our borders. So you know what's the most amazing thing? I happen to think of, you know, we have this DARPA program going through where they want to track all these credit card transactions. One of the real motivations for tracking credit card transactions right now is to catch tax cheats. It has nothing to do with terrorists. I mean, you know, maybe they'll catch some terrorists, but there's always double and triple purposes in this thing. Because what people are doing to avoid illegally evade tax are using offshore bank accounts. Money goes into that, and then they live off of credit card transactions, off of a credit card based in that bank. And so it never shows up in the U.S. system. It gets processed offshore. That's one of the motivations for wanting to do this stuff. If you've noticed, Dr. Stan, what we're doing right now is we're tracking Americans. We want to know everything Americans are doing. I don't know if you've noticed lately, in Nevada right now, they are turning prescription information over to law enforcement officials. A caller to the program in North Carolina, he'd had a heart attack recently, went to renew his driver's license. They wouldn't renew it because they were able to right then and there pull up all of his prescription medicines and his medical reports and things of that nature, and they made him go before a judge before he could get his license renewed. So if you've noticed, this little noose is closing around us, but our borders are wide open sieves. I go, this is absolute insanity.
I was reading there was a murder or rape or something in the South, and they wanted simply to get DNA from all the men in this area. They were going to collect DNA from 800 men in this community. And, of course, they said, well, you don't have to give it to us, but, of course, then we'll, of course, put your name in the paper, and everybody will know you wouldn't give DNA, and then we'll get a warrant, and we'll take it from you. No reason at all to suspect this man was guilty of anything. They're just collecting DNA samples from everyone. And, of course, all of these are steps along the way towards a totalitarian state. Now, many people in law enforcement said, boy, you know, DNA is a great means of getting the bad guys. But they don't understand that government can never be trusted with power, and especially when you have a phony war on terrorism. And when I say a phony war on terrorism, I mean just exactly that. If we were really interested in terrorism, we would make the Saudis, we would start arresting the Saudis who've been financing this whole terrorist movement. And anybody says anything about that, oh, we couldn't do that, you know. Why we defend the Saudis? We need their oil. And yet here are the people who've been financing this whole thing. And the Bush administration is doing everything they can to block the lawsuits that are going to sue the Saudis. Because if they have the lawsuits, they can get depositions. They can get people to swear under oath. They can get all sorts of records. And that's the last thing the Bush administration wants, is for the American people to find out that our close allies are the ones that not only provided the 15 of the 19 terrorists that plowed into the World Trade Center of the Pentagon, but they're the ones who financed this whole thing. And so instead of that, you know, we go to war with Afghanistan, and now we're going to go to war with Iraq. And then, of course, as you begin reading the paper, you find out that a lot of the military have been told that we're going to go to war maybe with Syria or Lebanon or Saudi Arabia or who else knows what other countries over there. This is not the end of the war. Even if it's a very, very quick war and there is no retaliation here in the United States, you can be sure that this is just the beginning of a number of wars. And all you have to do is read the history of what happened to ancient Rome as they went from war to war to war. And eventually, of course, they had to inflate their currency. It got completely out of control. In fact, in 320 or so, why Diocletian declared wage and price controls, about 300, and they just didn't work. I mean, he was going to enforce these wage and price controls with either exile or death if you violated his edicts, and it didn't work. And eventually abdicated and went off to raise cabbages someplace. But, you know, it was this rampant inflation that was the beginning of the end for the Roman Empire.
Yeah, and that's what finally does it. And it's interesting that empires tend to fall not because of factors from without. There may be a final attack from without. Empires tend to fall largely from within. And they collapse largely because of economic reasons, because once the economics falls apart, it's impossible to maintain the infrastructure or an army. And then finally, some exterior force just pushes it over the edge.
But of course, a lot of the fall of every empire has been the loss of its spiritual foundation. And that, of course, is the thing that's happened in America. We've lost our reason for being because we've lost the realization that our freedoms come from God. Unlike any other country ever in all of recorded history, we were the first nation who said that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men were created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. and that governments are formed among men to guarantee those rights. We'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will decide right now you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours every day, and we hope that if you listen, you agree with us, you'll be willing to sacrifice and help us do what we do. And I think we do differently than probably most of the other ministries on the air, because we approach things not only from a historical, but from a spiritual point of view. And we will give you the, for instance, our latest newsletter deals with the occult history of our monetary system. Now, you've probably never heard about the occult history of our monetary system. In fact, you don't even know what I'm talking about. But, of course, the modern banking really began with the Knights Templar, who were Luciferians. And we go into the background, not of what I say about it, but what they say about it, what Mandy P. Hall, who was a Satanist, says about the Templars and why, of course, action was taken against them. And then, of course, following on from the time of the Templars to where we are today, and, of course, the various forces working behind the scenes, working towards a New World Order and a New World Religion. Well, if you'd like, of course, to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, just pick up your phone and call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And, of course, if you can go to our website and pull down our newsletters and pull down our programs. But we hope, of course, if you out there and you'd like a free copy of our latest newsletter, which is the December newsletter that goes into the occult history of our monetary system, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And we'd be glad to send you a free copy of the newsletter if you haven't had one before. Of course, you might want to subscribe to the newsletter. That, of course, is your decision, but we'd be glad to get you a free copy of that newsletter. And then, of course, please tell your friends about our programs. Please copy the tapes on the better programs and distribute them. Programs aren't very good. Don't bother to distribute them. But, just tape over them and get a program that really does have a message you think will impact on people's lives. Feel free to copy our newsletters. Feel free to copy our videos, anyone that we produce. And, of course, help us to get the truth out across America from sea to shining sea. Well, Dr. Stan back here, and of course our special guest this evening is John Loeffler, and we're talking about what's going on in America today. That feeling that something is about to happen. Another shoe is ready to drop. Our telephone number is 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California, or 1-888-24-LIBERTY out across America. But of course, you have to understand that the economic system is beginning to crumble. We're facing a $35 billion deficit in California, and the only solution is massive layoffs, and the more people you lay off, the less people are going to be paying taxes. We've already lost 230,000 jobs here in California in the last year or so, and of course the dot-com industry is beginning to move out of California, and of course if Ray Davis raises the taxes on the corporations will move out, and they've already have this stupid law that if you work for any company here in California with more than just a handful of employees, you get 6 weeks off anytime you want to with pay, maybe your wife has a baby, maybe your husband wants to take off for a while. It doesn't really matter. All you need is an excuse and you can take off with pay for 6 weeks. Over in Switzerland, or in Sweden, where they've done this, about a third of the workforce is off almost all the time, one guise or another, and it just doesn't work out. People have to be paid for what they do, and if they don't want to work, you don't want to give them an excuse not to work. And, of course, what's an employer going to do if he's working on a narrow profit margin? Well, he's going to move to Nevada. He's going to move to Oregon. He's going to move some other place where you don't have these socialist programs, and that's what they are. They're socialist programs aimed at destroying the infrastructure of our free enterprise system. And, of course, if they raise the taxes on the individual, then individuals are going to leave the state. So they're going to have to cut spending. They're going to have to cut jobs. And, of course, they don't want to do any of these things. And this is the problem that we face today, is the fact that the people up in Sacramento are not prepared to make the cuts in the education, in the public park service. You know, what they'll want to probably do is say, oh, we're going to have to cut the police and the fire department. Oh, but we can't cut this massive bureaucracy. The first thing they ought to do away with is do away with the State Department of Education. And then they ought to simply put a hiring freeze on that nobody will be hired under any circumstances, and by attrition will begin laying off and cutting back on the number of government jobs. Of course, the state unions are screaming and saying, oh, the terrible thing, you know, tax the rich, tax the rich, tax the corporations, but don't take away what we have, you know, and they'll put it, bring all the pressure to bear that they can. But of course, if the legislators give in to this, I hope the Republicans don't, but they can destroy the whole infrastructure of this nation by destroying the economy of the state of California, which is today, according to the newspapers, the fifth largest economy in the entire world. Let me repeat that. The fifth largest economy in the entire world, if we were to imagine that, you know, California were a nation independent of the United States. The first nation would probably be the United States. The second economy would be Japan. The third one would probably be Germany. The fourth one would be China. And the fifth economy would be the state of California. And with it in the hands of Gray Davis, we would probably be better to have Chairman Mao in charge than Gray Davis. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. You know, we are in real trouble financially. If you're watching what's happening to silver, you know, it was at 430, it's up to 480, 85. Platinum's on the rise, 618, 616. Yesterday, gold has broken through the 350 level. And, of course, it's only a matter of time before it goes higher. The dollar is beginning to fall. If you look and see what's happening to our production capacity, our industries continue moving offshore, and we're having real problems in California.
That's why I don't live there.
Right. But
Bill Murphy thinks gold's going to go to 800 to 1,000.
Now, who is Bill Murphy, and why should we believe him?
Gold Antitrust Action Committee. That's his specialty. Is, you know, he's been tracking the whole issue of the artificial suppression of the gold price and everything like that. Silver will tend to slingshot too, probably even harder than gold, because this within 12 months we're facing a commercial shortage as a commodity, in addition to its tendency to swing along with gold. You know, the interesting thing you mentioned about that, there was something very critical that you said there, and that was the issue of, like, say, in California, Grayout Davis will continue to raise taxes. In the liberal states, they're just, without abandon, they're just, you know, the answer is to raise taxes. Now, the economy can't take it. People can't take it. At least in, like, Idaho and the conservative states, what they're going is, well, they've cut already. I mean, Governor Kempthorne here made some massive slashes in the state budget. And then, of course, all the social programs start moaning and groaning and screaming, yelling like a bunch of spoiled kids. But the one thing they do in this situation, this is especially true in areas of education, wherever they get the thumbs down, what they will do is they will immediately cut the services to the public. In other words, the purpose for which they were established and put there is to make the public feel the pain. They will never think of cutting the bloated bureaucracy and the fat cat salaries that people at the top are paid. That will never be taken care of. And it's interesting that in government we have debates over whether we should cut taxes in a declining economy, whenever any realistic economist knows that taxes are always a load on the economy because they never put anything useful into the economy. It's always a load. It does not create wealth. And there's a straight correlation between cutting taxes and seeing an increase in the economy. The second thing that's always interesting is we've heard all these Congress people talk about how wonderful they care about people, yada yada, the little guy, tax cuts for the rich, you know the whole shtick. But what nobody's ever pointed out to these guys is the fact that the marriage penalty tax has warred against the American family for decades, and that just because my wife and I are married, when we file a return, we pay a substantially higher tax than if we were just two people shacking up together and filing separate returns.
Well, John, did you ever wonder why that was? I mean, you know, it's illogical unless you recognize that you get what you want. In other words, you use the tax code to obtain a social end. And the tax code has been used to discourage marriage. And it's very simple. They know what they're doing. If you want to get people to work hard, you reward them with the tax cuts and breaks for working hard. If you don't want people to work hard, you, of course, give them welfare, and then they don't work hard. If you want people to get married, why, of course, you do away with the marriage tax. But if you don't want people to get married, you keep the marriage tax on there. And they know exactly what they were doing all along, because, of course, married people very often will have children. And this all has to do with population control and, of course, the destruction of the family. These people are not stupid. They know exactly what they're doing. So maybe some of the congressmen are, but the real architects about this, the people who hold the reins of power in both political parties, understand the marriage tax. It is there for a purpose, not by accident. It's not that they're stupid. They're using the tax code to encourage what they want, and that is the destruction of the family.
Also reduce population.
Right.
Had this whole thing. So what you do is you put pressure on the family. Put pressure like they have a deduction for teachers, for example, who are unreimbursed for their things, but then they put a note in there. But that's not for homeschoolers, see? And so we maintain systems which are worthless, failing, bloated, overbearing. We won't reform. There is no such thing as reform. And we penalize the other. But people are taking these back in their own hands, Stan, and they're cheating. You're starting to see this more and more and more. People are taking cash, asking for cash in transactions. As the economy is collapsing, people are just saying, well, that was nice, sayonara, I'm out of here. I'm either not filing a return, and there are just probably large numbers of people that don't, that manage to do a day workers and whatever, or they cheat, or they barter, or things like that. Remember, there are three things that people always do when the tax becomes abusive. It's either fight, flight, or fraud.
That's an interesting concept. Fight, flight, or fraud.
Yeah, fight, flight, or fraud. They will either fight, I mean, as in the when we had the Boston Tea Party, or a revolution, or protests in the street, or they will flee from the jurisdiction of the tax, or move their money from that jurisdiction, or they will just commit fraud. Those are the three mechanisms that are traditionally used when a tax becomes abusive. And our tax is abusive. We've moved the entire burden up onto family people and onto people who make, say, more than $70,000 a year. And $70,000 really for a large family just doesn't cut it anymore, Dr. Stan. You know, that was a great salary when you and I were growing up, but it isn't anymore. You just can't. With the skyrocketing inflation, see, at the same time we've stung the back way. So basically what's really funny is that the politicians don't think it at all that we should be aggrieved when about 50% of our year is spent working for some government agency by the time we pay off all of our taxes. This to them is not enough. And then you have to ask yourself, what am I getting in return for this? Think about it. Think about how many government benefits you have gotten in the course of your lifetime. I can't think of very many. Can you? And I do know that the roads that they're supposed to be paving don't always get paved. And the services I'm supposed to get. And I keep wondering, why does every time I go and have to do something for the state, even to get a driver's license, I have to pay a fee? Now, wait a minute. Where's all this tax money going? But this is how the game is played. Up here in our location in Coeur d'Alene, they ran through a sales tax issue. We only have a state sales tax here. We don't have local taxes and everything. It's against the state constitution. But they ran one through. We were going to have a county sales tax to pay for an addition to our jail because they said we had to have a bigger jail. Now, the whole prison system in the country is a game. We have real hardcore prisoners, there's no doubt about it. But probably about a fourth of the people that are in there you could let out because they've committed what are called victimless crimes and stuff like that. We're almost going to have to make that decision. A friend of mine who's in the parole system here who works there said they're going to have to make that decision in January to do that because they already can't do it. But what they did here in the jail when they wanted to build a jail is they had the state system ship in a bunch of prisoners. So they overpacked the jail. Then they called the media and said, look, we're just crawling off the walls here. And they put that in. And finally they managed to ram that sales tax through on an off year. And then as soon as the media were gone, by the way, they shipped the prisoners back out. And so now we built this whole jail, and lo and behold, the state Supreme Court said, nope, that's an unconstitutional tax, can't do it. So we have this whole built jail with a giant tax bill that we didn't need. And now the property owners in the area are going to probably have to pick up the bill, and I'm waiting for the revolt on that side.
Well, you know, it's really very interesting, but in Kentucky, why they're beginning to release prisoners, because they don't have enough money to keep them in jail. And so they're letting prisoners out. They try not to let any too many violent felons out, but they're going to have to release prisoners. They're going to have to release prisoners here in California. There's just no question that's one of the places they can begin making cuts. This is going to be happening all across America. Now, this is exactly what happens before a country begins to crumble from within. This is what happened over in Iran just before the Shah was forced out of power. We put pressure on him to let all the political prisoners out of prison. And once he did that, of course, they were out in the streets demonstrating and creating all sorts of problems. What's going to happen in the United States when we cut back on law enforcement and begin letting a lot of the prisoners who are in prison out of prison? Now, I think that if you have nonviolent prisoners, you probably ought to let them go. People who cheat on the income tax, things of that sort, let them stay at home or something like that. But they're not the ones that they're going to they're going to let the violent ones out.
Right.
And don't you think for one minute they're not going to. That's what this whole thing about doing away with three strikes and you're out. That's why they've misused three strikes and you're out here in California. I mean, I think that the three strikes, if they're really serious felony counts, these are habitual criminals, they ought to be put away. So what did they do? They take some guy who's had two strikes, and then he steals a package of gum, and they say, three strikes, you're in forever the rest of your life, and they do all these absurd things. This is exactly what they've done as far as capital punishment, where they've actually convicted innocent people by falsifying the record, by falsifying the evidence and withholding evidence, and the prosecutors who do that ought to go to prison themselves. And instead of that, now they're saying, oh, look, we found over 100 people condemned to death, and we've exonerated them on the DNA evidence, and it was simply because you had corrupt prosecutors who should be in prison themselves for violating the laws, because, of course, everybody has to abide by the law.
Right.
But so, because you've corrupted the law, why, of course, you're going to do away with a very valid means of punishment. Now, right now, I'm concerned about capital punishment, because not because I don't believe in capital punishment, but because I happen to believe they've intentionally put innocent people who they knew were innocent in prison and many times on death row. We know that the FBI sent a man to prison for 30 years who they knew was innocent protect one of their murderers. We were using as an informant. If you don't believe that, you need to read the book Deadly Alliance, which is one of the books we carry. So vitally important. Now, if you can't trust the FBI, who can you trust? Well, let's go to Nathan, who's calling from Contra Costa County. Nathan, do you have a question or comment?
Well, first, let me just say that definitely nonviolent prisoners need to be gotten into a program involving something to do with restitution. And violent prisoners, hey, murder, rape, as far as I'm concerned, I think we need to really, to make the death penalty more fair, we need to, A, have a proper conviction, okay, no falsifying evidence, but B, you know, frankly, I don't understand why one first or second degree murder shouldn't be the standard. Now, that's my opinion, okay, right or wrong. I don't know. I'll leave that to the audience to mull over. My basic question, though, is this is maybe kind of a devil's advocate question on the issue of taxation.
You know what they did to the devil's advocate, don't you? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's okay. It's I'm not the devil's advocate.
Okay,
so I'm just
fine.
Saying. I'm just playing a little opposition for sake of argument. What would you make of the argument that the American Revolution was mainly fought over no taxation without representation, as opposed to modern-day taxation in which there is representation? Now, this is not my argument. I'm just curious to how you would respond to that, because it is probably the argument that would be made by those who would defend the modern-day democratic welfare state. So I'll put that out there and take it off the air.
Not sure what your question is.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the question is. Oh, okay, no. You mentioned the American Revolution and taxation.
All right, fine. And of course, we were told that the American Revolution came about because the claim was no taxation without representation. Now we have taxation within representation, with representation, and look how bad things are. Is that what you're saying?
No. Well, not necessarily. I'm just saying, would you acknowledge that there is a moral difference, or do you think that it's just as bad either way, is I guess what I'm trying to get at.
You mean taxation per se?
Yeah, in other words, theoretically, we can vote for lower taxes. we the people.
No, we can't, because our representatives don't represent us. Unfortunately, you have to understand that the people of the state of California voted for Proposition 13. The politicians have done everything they can to figure out ways around Proposition 13, because the reason you had to have Proposition 13 was the people had no say on the taxation, and they were simply taxing people out of their homes. So because politicians are like a hungry lion, they always have to have more and more and more money and higher salaries and bigger and better perks for themselves and the people who vote for them and all their cronies. And so they were taxing the people out of their homes, and so the people passed Proposition 13, and then subtly, little by little, they found a ways around Proposition 13 so they could get more money from the people.
Well, see, but they passed Proposition 13, but they didn't pass spending limits. They passed taxing limits. And that's exactly what I think it was Professor Andrew Taylor or somebody warned with when, you know, the claim is that when we become a democracy, a pure democracy, people would vote in, you know, they would be maybe opposed to taxation, but not necessarily to spending. I.e., if someone else pays for it, it's okay. So, I mean, if you're going to pass tax limits, you would also theoretically have to pass spending limits. It would only be fair, or at least it would only be consistent, unless you want to run up a huge deficit. Now, again, I'm not really taking a position in this argument. I'm just, is there a difference in your mind between taxation with representation or taxation without representation, or at this point, does it matter? Have we become so altered from our early form of government that at this point it's bad either way?
Well, let me just give you that quotation from Andrew Taylor. A democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until a majority of the voters discover they can vote themselves largest from the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidate promising the most benefits from the public treasury, with the result that a democracy always collapses over loose fiscal policy, always followed by a dictatorship. And that's, of course, why our liberals today want a dictatorship, and why Karl Marx, pardon me, that's why our liberals want democracy, that's why Karl Marx in the Communist Manifesto advocated democracy rather than our Republican form of government. John, do you want to tackle Nathan's question?
Well, I'm not sure what the point of it is. I mean, I guess I'll go back to Leffler's famous question, so what?
Okay. All right, well, then I'll just leave off with this, that I think there's one exception to why, even though we have become more of a democracy, that we haven't followed that road just yet, and that's because of our Judeo-Christian heritage. But once we lose that, then yes, I believe we'll probably go the same way as the rest of those. So
right, but that's under attack right now, understand. I mean,
oh yeah,
if there's one thing it's PC and kosher to attack, it's the Judeo-Christian heritage of morality and structure and even the concept of law. And so that's already gone the way of the dinosaur.
Sadly, yes.
Something
okay, I appreciate it, gentlemen. I'm sorry I didn't phrase my question.
Okay, thanks so much, Nathan. But I think that one of the things that we might very well stress here is that under our democratic, under our Republican system, why our representatives couldn't be voting on so many of the things that they're doing. They couldn't be, creating all these government programs that, of course, steal from us the product of our labor. But since we have convinced the public we are a democracy, then, of course, our legislators can vote for whatever they want to, for higher salaries for themselves. They want to give this one a couple of billion dollars and that one a couple of billion dollars, and we'll give a couple of billion dollars to Argentina and a couple of billion dollars to Brazil, and we'll have our troops in 140 nations. And where do they get off doing all of these things? All of them are unconstitutional. Well, they say we're a democracy, so our elected representatives can do whatever they want to. No, we're a republic, and our elected representatives are violating the oath that they swore to defend the Constitution against all enemies, domestic and foreign, and a lot of our elected representatives are domestic enemies of the Constitution they've sworn to uphold.
Well, not only that, we believe in a living, breathing Constitution. I was thinking of writing an article called Night of the Living Constitution, you know, and what they mean when we have a living, breathing, that's versus a strict constructionist. A strict constructionist believes the Constitution means what it says. A living, breathing advocate such as Vice President Gore believes that basically, you know, the argument they will use, well, the founding fathers 200 years ago couldn't possibly have foreseen the issues we're dealing with today. Well, they actually did. They put a process in there for changing the Constitution. It's called an amendment. What they don't want to do is they don't want to have to amend it because it's a difficult process. You have to have a serious reason for amending it. What they want to be able to do is reinterpret what it means by changing the definitions of is and other things like that. And that's what they want to do with it. That's what the living, breathing Constitution is. Why this isn't really obvious to everybody very quickly that, well, if it doesn't mean anything, then it can mean what it has to mean when you have to be guilty or when your rights can be done away with. It doesn't make any difference anyway. The Constitution's almost gone under the boards. There are some courts that'll uphold it. For the most part, we've pretty well flushed most of it down. Right now, it's lip service to it. As Ron Paul told me when we talked, he said the concept that senators and congressmen would be there to defend the rights of the constituency and to uphold the Constitution is totally passe in Washington.
Now, of course, that was why they had to get the 17th Amendment through, to make the senators answerable to the people, actually answerable to the people of great wealth,
right.
So that they could buy and sell the senators. Up to that time, the senators were not answerable to the people of great wealth. They were answerable to their state legislatures. They represented
Correct.
The states, not the people.
Right.
The whole idea of the 7th Amendment was to begin moving us away from our Republican concept into the democracy we have become, which it will soon become a dictatorship. That is exactly what Andrew Tyler forecast before our Constitution was written. And this is exactly what Plato wrote. He said, democracies descend into despotism. There's nothing new under the sun. It's just that we have so dumbed down the American people, they don't even know what Plato said.
Who was Plato? Then there was another Greek guy, Socrates.
Shame on you. Well, anyway, of course, we'll go ahead. What are your parting thoughts for our listeners this evening, John?
Well, you know what? I'll be honest with you, Dr. Stan. From a Christian point of view, I have much more optimism because I know where I've come from and I know where I'm going. Countries have been through rough times before. These are cycles that countries go through. And so it's nothing abnormal. As a matter of fact, everything we're seeing has been seen before. And so there's reason to have hope. Even if we can't turn that situation around, ultimately we get into a place that's positive and worthwhile. Doesn't mean it may not be a rough ride in between, but we should certainly keep looking up.
Amen to that. Well, that really is the source of our hope, the source of our inspiration. John Leffler, thank you so much for being with us tonight. Oh, do you have a website you'd like to put out?
Yeah, www.steelonsteel.com. Steel like the metal, steelonsteel.com.
And go there and you can listen to John's programs, and you'll always have a smile when you listen to him. God bless you. Good night.
God bless.
And say good night to Carol. Bye-bye. Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan, and I hope you enjoyed our program. Just sort of a little lighthearted chat, but covering the fact that we are on the fringe of an economic collapse here in the United States. And, of course, they're doing everything to keep you from realizing that, but more and more jobs are being lost. More and more of our major industries are moving offshore. Our own automotive industry is having ever smaller percentage of the automotive business. They keep telling you how well our automotive companies are doing. They don't tell you that they all owe a great deal of money to their pension funds. There's not going to be any profits there for a number of years. Well, we're in real trouble. On the other hand, God is still in control. And so, of course, remember to pray for America. Pray for revival and pray for our leaders and ministers, but please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.
Successful and, you know, created the type of society. The rest of them just destroy the existing society and led to more chaos. So, I mean, the, what they tell us, in, you know, it had to do with taxation. Other people say, no, it was they didn't want us to create our own money. There are all sorts of reasons that are given. You know, there was a large Masonic component involved, and that they wanted a revolution. They wanted to get out from underneath the king. What we need to do is get good people to write. And, you know, what we need to do is get people, enough people who are willing to commit themselves to go up there to Sacramento and try to take this state back. That's all we can do. Absolutely, well, we've got to support them more than just